go into the technical content of our presentation, I wanted to give everybody a brief overview of the Design and Construction at Hazardous Waste Sites group that is the collaboration between EPA and the Society of American Military Engineers. This has been a collaboration between the two groups that has been going on for upwards of 7 years at this point. And through a series of interactive events, both in person, historically, and webinars, we have the objectives of facilitating open and frank information exchange amongst professionals from both the private and public sectors regarding design and construction issues at hazardous waste sites. This includes discussions on project delivery, contracting, technologies, effective methods, challenges, lessons learned. It provides a forum for presentations describing current practices and approaches, again, focusing on project management and field experiences in this area. It also enhances the communication network and promotes continued discussion amongst design and construction professionals. So there are a number of events that EPA and the Society of American Military Engineers put on. The first two are symposium events. Historically, we have held one in Philadelphia, which is called DCHWS East. We had to unfortunately postpone the event that was in April 2020, but we have already secured a 2021 date at the end of March, early April. There's a sister symposium in the West. We started that about 5 years ago. It is currently scheduled for October of 2020. Since we had to cancel the April 2020 event in the East, we are actually moving a majority of the agenda from the East and delivering it in the West Symposium while adding some additional presentations from the west side of the country. In addition to those symposium events, we are having a seminar series which includes webinars, of which this is one of them, as well as an in-person training that we are currently developing, which we are planning for in-person delivery in the fall. The seminar series, as I mentioned before, includes monthly webinars. We've had a webinar every month since September of 2019. We have some webinars planned for June, July, and August. I'll talk a little bit about those on a following slide. The webinars that we have, again, are focused on the design and construction issues topics and really range from a large variety of presentations, project management, technology, site investigation, innovative approaches, stuff like that. We've done a number of presentations, which were actually longer versions of some of the presentations we've had at past symposiums, as well as other topics that we haven't been able to hold at different symposiums. Upcoming webinars. As I mentioned before, the large symposium event that we had scheduled for April of 2020, which was postponed, a majority of the agenda is being moved to the West Symposium in October, but some entities were not able to attend the Denver delivery, so we are actually working for the next couple deliveries, June, July, and August, to try to bring you all some of those presentations and set up some panels. So I apologize, we don't have actual titles for the June, July, and August webinar series, but I encourage you to keep an ear to the ground, look at Tech Direct, which is the newsletter that comes out that announces webinars every month, and we'll try to get that information out to you as soon as I can nail down the agenda for the June, July, and August deliveries. So before I turn it over to our presenters, I'd like to introduce both of them. Our first presenter is Melissa Harkle-Rode from CDM Smith. She is an environmental sustainability scientist and technical specialist for CDM Smith. She specializes in the development of innovative risk management solutions that maximize sustainable and resilient project outcomes, and a past at-large board member for the Sustainable Remediation Forum, SURF. Mitch Heineman from CDM Smith is our other presenter. He has 3 decades of experience in hydrology, hydraulics, and collection systems analysis. Since 2015, he has been a senior technical advisor for the firm's water resources practice. He has extensive experience developing models using the EPA stormwater management model, InfoWorks, and is a leading contributor to the development of this software, And last, he is the principal developer of CDM Smith's NetStorm software, which is used for precipitation frequency analysis, SLIM pre- and post-processing, and collection system modeling. That is a mouthful. So Mel and Mitch, I am going to turn it over to you for the technical part of our presentation. Thank you, everyone.
Great. Thanks so much. And really looking forward to presenting during today's EPA CLUIN DCHWS seminar. So thank you for the invitation. So I'm going to start off the presentation with a brief overview of a sustainable resilient remediation framework. That is a mouthful, so I'm going to be using SRR as an acronym moving forward. Touch upon guidance updates and related technical initiatives, and then followed by four case studies showcasing SRR assessments and findings. And we'll have Q&A trickled throughout. So to start off with the sustainable resilient remediation overview and updates. Just real quick, I always think it's a good practice to revisit the terminology or definitions of sustainability and resiliency when we're talking about these two topics together. The triple bottom line of sustainability is environmental preservation, economic opportunity, and social benefits, while the three pillars of resiliency is risk, plan, and manage so that you are adaptable to any severe weather event or climate change related hazard. The New York Times has a really great quote where they state, where sustainability aims to put the world back into balance, resilience looks for ways to manage in an imbalanced world. So a sustainable resilient risk management framework, an example of how that framework would be laid out is shown in this slide. And really what it is it's a site-specific approach to identify, evaluate, select, and implement actions that are resilient to climate change and extreme weather event-related impacts, as well as mitigate unintended environmental, social, and economic impacts from cleanup and restoration activities. The conceptual site model is a great opportunity to evaluate site-specific physical characteristics, drivers, and stakeholder values in the context of sustainability and resiliency. There are several federal, state, and organizational guidance on green and sustainable remediation, which I'm not going to summarize here. But for the most part, the approach of performing a sustainability assessment or green and sustainable remediation assessment for a site is pretty similar among all those different guidances. And the first step, you're pulling together your data inventory. So that would be your components of your remedial system and any sort of monitoring and investigation activities, so installation of wells, building of support infrastructure, any sort of earthwork equipment that you're utilizing, and incorporating that data inventory first into an environmental footprint tool. Common tools that are used is SiteWise and EPA's spreadsheet for environmental footprint analysis, CEFA. These environmental footprint tools have outputs in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, NOx, SOx emissions, total water consumption, energy consumption. There are remedial components that may not be representative in these tools, such as particular capping material or any sort of proprietary amendments that may be used at your site. So what you can do is calculate that environmental footprint using life cycle assessment and incorporate those carbon footprint equivalents into your environmental footprint tool. From there, in step 3B, outside of that environmental footprint analysis, you typically do a qualitative evaluation of unintended community impacts that may arise from site activities, traffic, truck hauling traffic, dust suppression, mitigation, any sort of stakeholder needs and values that were identified that needs to be met as part of your strategy. And then also there are other costs that can be quantified, such as restoration benefits, economic stimulus from your strategies that you can incorporate into your analysis. And then from your environmental footprint metrics, like greenhouse gas emissions, you can extend those to relate what those emissions are in terms of contributing to climate change by incorporating social costs of that particular metric, like social cost of carbon. After you do your analysis, you want to identify your sustainable risk management approach, identify best management practices that can be incorporated to optimize your strategy, and then during implementation and monitoring, you continuously evaluate your sustainable and resilient aspects of your remedy and continue to incorporate the MPs. To perform a resilient remediation assessment, EPA has compiled information resources and tools to help practitioners evaluate a remedial action's exposure and sensitivity to climate change-related hazards, which is summarized in the call-out box here. Performance of a vulnerability assessment informs on the likelihood and severity of risk that extreme weather or change or climate change-related hazard may have on remedy effectiveness in both short- and long-term planning horizons. And there's a website link here that provides you to EPA, directs you to EPA's resources. EPA's resilient remediation evaluation approach is comprised of three major components. First, you identify climate change-related hazards and which remedy components are vulnerable to those hazards. You then identify and prioritize adaptation measures to increase the adaptive capacity to your system if one of those events occurred. And then you want to implement and continuously evaluate your remedial action to see if the vulnerability or the adaptive capacity of the system has changed based on changing physical conditions, right? We are feeling the effects of climate change as we know it, and we know we are living in a dynamic system, so we need to be sure we're continuously re-equilibrating ourselves as to what the current site conditions that we're managing our sites in. And it also, stakeholder values may change. There may be a particular sea level rise scenario or planning scenario that a stakeholder group would prefer a remedy is designed for. And those may change as our knowledge of climate science evolves over time. So EPA has three climate resilience technical fact sheets that serve as a site-specific planning tool by describing the vulnerability assessment approach, provide examples of adaptation measures that may increase resilience of a system, and outline steps to assure adaptive capacity of a system as climate conditions continue to change. These were recently updated in October 2019 and an excellent resource. There are additional tools that are available from other state and federal agencies. This slide is just showing an example from Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection. They have a web-based platform so that you can look at different climate change drivers such as sea level rise, flooding, temperature projections for a particular property. So this is another good tool for, you know, defining what resiliency is for your particular site in your conceptual site model and do some initial planning even during the site assessment and remedial investigation stage. And then lastly, before jumping into the case studies, the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council has a sustainable resilient remediation team in which we are updating the GSR1 and GSR2 technical regulatory guidances to incorporate resiliency as well as any information method gaps we had in sustainable remediation assessments. So that includes incorporation of social metrics, engagement of stakeholders to help define sustainable resilient remediation and the process by which you go about performing that, and capturing other triple bottom line hidden benefits that do not directly relate to the remedy or risk reduction. So if you're interested, check out the team page I have on the slide here. We'd be happy to have you contribute, and the plan is to have the guidance ready for external review in July. So it'd be great to have everyone's support and feedback on that document. So before I dive into the case studies, I guess I just wanted to pause to see if there was any initial questions on that background information.
So I'll remind the audience that you can send your questions and comments into the Q&A window in the lower right. If you don't have any questions, it's also equally as helpful if you can put that in. So if you have no questions for Melissa, feel free to put in no questions now, and we'll move on. Right now, Melissa, what I'm seeing are some questions about SAMI events and how to stay in touch with those. And I'm now starting to see a number of people just chiming in that they're able to follow along and they don't have any questions at this time. So feel free to carry on, but we will pause again. Oh, just hang tight. I do see a question that just came in.
Okay.
And so one of the attendees would like to know, is there a regulatory driver for this type of an evaluation?
That's a good question. So EPA issued a memorandum in 2016, which speaks to incorporating green remediation principles as part of your remedial investigation activities, remedy selection, design, you know, operations throughout the process. It does not speak specifically to resiliency or the economic or social dimensions. However, I think there is the opportunity and the language in that memorandum available to have that be a supporting document to move forward with implementing and selecting strategies that are adaptive to any sort of climate change hazards, right, that resilient risk management, but also minimize any unintended environmental, economic, and social consequences from remedial activities, as well as maximizing, you know, the benefits of the triple bottom line. I think one other thing important to note, and I am not from the EPA, so I don't want to pretend I'm wearing the EPA hat, but in conversations, you know, the community acceptance within the NCP criteria is also seen as a opportunity to capture the social and economic dimension of sustainable remediation. From a long-term effectiveness perspective, we want to be sure that our systems are resilient to any future climate change hazard events or severe weather events. So we don't want our remedy to be undermined. So you can look at it from a long-term effectiveness metric. And then from a short-term effectiveness, just minimizing any of those, you know, impacts pertaining to environmental, social, and economic dimensions of sustainability.
Okay. We did have a question. You had mentioned the ITRC team. They wanted to know if you had any sense of a time frame for the ITRC SRR to develop a framework.
So we are developing a framework of sorts to help guide practitioners in planning a sustainable resilience assessment, helping them identify what type of metrics and tools that would best meet their site needs and be in alignment with their stakeholder values. And a lot of it touches upon the overviews that I was giving in those previous slides of the sustainable assessment process, the resiliency evaluation process that the EPA has prepared. So all that's going to be included in this revised guidance. So I would really advocate for people to either join the team or at least be part of external review so that if there's anything missing, you call that out and we're able to incorporate it into the guide.
Okay. We have had a few other individuals chime in with examples of state regulations related to resiliency or green cleanups. Yeah, so it's just like a number of state regulators wanted to chime in that even if EPA didn't have it, they have it in their states. And then just one other clarifying question. Can you remind everyone what you meant by a, quote, triple bottom line?
Sure. So sustainability is comprised of three overall components, and that would be your environmental component, your economic component, and then your social component. And those three components are referred to as the triple bottom line of sustainability.
All right, great. I think in the interest of time, we can carry on with the presentation. I want to thank the audience for sharing their questions. And let you know you can continue to submit them at any time.
Okay. I did lose ability to move the slides because my internet went out. So if I can just go to, if someone can move the slide for me, we could go to case study one, Santa Susana Field Laboratory slide.
Absolutely. We're there now.
Okay. So this is our first case study, the Santa Susana Field Laboratory area for site is approximately 290 acres, including 90 acres in which the Energy Technology Engineering Center once operated. The center performs liquid metals research, metals compatibility testing, and operated 10-plus small nuclear reactors over the years of operation. Chemical and radiological releases impacted soil, bedrock, and groundwater. All radioactive materials have been removed, and all but two reactor buildings have been demolished. Previous cleanup of radioactive buildings, soil, and bedrock performed to the standards established in the 1980s and 90s. For remaining cleanup, this would be to clean up remaining soil contamination under the 2010 administrative order on consent for remedial action issued by DOE, by DTSC. A environmental impact assessment was prepared to evaluate the three cleanup scenarios, alternatives A, B, and C, as you see here on the slide, which have varying removal volumes to clean up to three different cleanup criteria. Next slide, please. So a cost risk analysis was performed for four historical operation areas that represent 70% of the remaining radionuclide contamination at the site. The analysis is representative of the exposure area's current condition. It provides a range of chemical constituents characteristic of Area 4 operations and represents the upper boundary in Area 4 for cancer, non-cancer risk. Next slide. This figure shows the four areas in a green line, a blue line, an orange line, and a yellow line. I'm sorry I'm not able to point those out physically at the moment. But you'll see along the horizontal axis those four areas in the legend. So the reduction in the remaining cancer risk following the removal action under each scenario, so alternative A, B, and C, is highlighted in the brown-orange shading. The cost of each scenario is shown in the dashed blue line. So this cost-risk analysis determines that an additional reduction in risks between alternative B and C were minimal. However, the differential in overall cost of implementation varied significantly. Next slide, please. So this figure is a normalization of the previous figure, which is a cleaner format to review the cost-risk analysis findings. Again, no significant difference between overall risk reduction from implementing alternative B, which is cleanup to revise LUT values, compared to alternative C, which is cleanup the area of concern lookup table values. The additional volume of soil removed in alternative C is ultimately driving the cost. Okay, and I'm back online, so now I can use that here. Okay. In addition, we also performed a green and sustainable remediation assessment to support the cost risk analysis evaluation. So we did an environmental footprint analysis using the SiteWise environmental footprint tool. This bar graph shows the relative chemical emissions and resource consumption footprint for each alternative relative to the alternative with the greatest footprint for a particular metric. I don't think it's anyone's surprise that alternative C would have the highest overall environmental footprint since it was removing the most amount of material from the site. But then when you need, what's interesting when you start kind of looking at these figures is, you know, what the difference between A and B, is this really a significant difference, or do they have relatively similar and overall environmental footprints? So to help have that conversation, we normalize our environmental metrics into one single monetary unit that helps us with the comparison. So as you can see here, for greenhouse gas emissions, alternative A, B, and C has each an output for the different scenarios. If we apply the social cost of greenhouse gas emissions, which represents the money that we spend as a society to combat climate change and other issues related to greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere, if we apply that amount and total it up down here, we get an overall number. And then we can totalize the social costs for a little bit easier comparison of the environmental metrics. For the community impact analysis, we did a qualitative analysis to rate relative short-term impacts to the community from excavation activities, traffic congestion, noise and dust generation, water consumption. We also looked at natural resource loss, so how much landfill space we will be taking up and clean soil that would have to be used on site, as well as time frame for cleanup activities. And then what we did is we pulled all these results together from the cost risk analysis and the green and sustainable remediation assessment into a single matrix to help perform an overall comparison among the three alternatives. So this matrix serves as a tool to just help inform on the cost and sustainable footprint of the different scenarios. You know, a lot of the time I think we look at, you know, are we always going towards the cleanup option that has the smallest footprint, and is that going to drive the decision-making process? This is more of a higher-level comment here. And you really need to look at it, you know, from the bigger picture, you could take in consideration costs and risk and have that be a more comprehensive evaluation by including these all into one single matrix. So in conclusion for this case study, cleanup to more stringent cleanup levels didn't necessarily result in a better solution for reducing risk to human health or the environment. That risk reduction really didn't increase by implementing alternative C. By combining risk, cost analysis, and GSR assessments, decision makers see a more complete picture and can make an informed remedial alternative selection. And these tools can be a really great communication tool for the public and other interested parties. Okay. I'm going to present on case study 2 now, and then I'll stop for questions. So case study 2 is on EPA's Region 3 BORIT Asbestos Superfund site. BORIT includes 3 adjacent parcels. The park parcel is approximately 19 acres. The reservoir parcel is approximately 18 acres. And the asbestos pile parcel is approximately 6.5 acres. The site also includes portions of Wissahickon Creek, Rose Valley Creek, and Tannery Run, which flow adjacent to the 3 site parcels. The site is a result of asbestos disposal operation for products such as paper, millboard, electrical insulation, and a whole other compilation of commercial and materials were disposed of. The site was capped by EPA, and this slide details institutional controls implemented as part of the remedy. Before the remedy was selected, we did do a GSR assessment as part of the feasibility study using a very similar approach as Santa Susana, but we use the EPA CEPA tool instead of the SiteWise tool. And we did normalize all those environmental metrics into one monetary unit to, again, help us have an overall comparison of the environmental footprint in a little bit of an easier format. So the results from the GSR assessment suggest that alternative 2, capping, would contribute the least overall impact under the triple bottom line. So that would be the economic, social, and environmental dimensions. Alternative 3, which is in orange, excavation off-site disposal, would have the most detrimental effect on the community due to increased truck hauling and anticipated congestion. Alternative 4, which is gray, is in-situ dual heating. And alternative 5, excavation and thermal chemical conversion treatment would contribute the most towards the environmental footprint just because the amount of energy use that is required. Alternative 4 in situ dual heating would have a greater contribution to the environmental impact from emissions and energy use. In addition, alternatives 4 and 5 would likely result in additional infrastructure on the property to supply an electricity source, and it could potentially devalue the aesthetics of the parcel and may prevent individuals from using it for recreational purposes. Also, we performed a qualitative resiliency evaluation during the FS to identify remedial alternatives that were vulnerable to potential climate change-related hazards and, identify considerations to help inform remedy selection. Move this arrow out of the way. In summary, the site is in the vicinity of several surface water bodies and within the 100-year flood zone. Technologies that would leave inert material in place, such as alternative 4, in situ dual heating, could potentially impact floodplain hydraulics and storage capacity. Several other climate change factors were identified for the site, including potential for heat wave events, which could have an impact on your energy or electricity supply that you would need at your site. Increased precipitation that could increase the surface water flow within water bodies on your site, as well as potential increase in flood risk and storm events. Adverse impact from these factors can include erosion of cap material, slope failure, material washout, above ground infrastructure damage, and power outages. So we wanted to, do this evaluation to identify our vulnerable components, not only to inform remedy selection, but to also once the remedy is selected, you identify the management practices from both a sustainability and a resiliency perspective to manage those risks as much as possible. The selected remedy for the site was capping. The stream bank and reservoir capping approach were different to account for erosion. And there's just some diagrams of the different capping that was implemented on the site. This is a photo of the Wissahickon Creek before and after the slope was stabilized and the material was removed and capped. Let's see. Can I play this? So significant flooding occurred during the removal action, which caused the remedy to fail in Rose Valley Creek, requiring additional anchors to be used on the concrete cable mats. This photo is actually showing flooding at the Wissahickon Creek during one significant flood event. Because we're seeing these events occur in real time. The public during the comment period brought up several inquiries pertaining to how the integrity of the remedial action will be maintained to be resilient to current and future flood events and other severe weather events. And this further supported implementation of climate change vulnerability monitoring during O&M of the CAP remedial action. So EPA incorporated climate change vulnerability monitoring into the O&M plan and current O&M operations that are being performed at the site to proactively assess whether changes in site hydrologic conditions and extreme weather events have the potential to undermine the integrity of the remedial action. This element of the remedial action O&M is in accordance with EPA's climate change adaptation plan. So that was a resource I didn't mention previously. So that would be another regulatory document you can reference. Continuous collection of site water body water levels and surface water flow will help inform us as practitioners on whether the remedial action design conditions have changed over time and then prompt implementation of adaptation measures to maintain remedial action effectiveness. So for example, if the slope stabilization was designed to withstand a specific surface water flow, increases in the severity and frequency of precipitation events over time may increase surface water flow that exceed our original design conditions. Doing this climate change vulnerability monitoring and collecting, continuous data, which can be evaluated on a quarterly basis and also during the five-year review, again, to proactively determine if changes in site conditions prompt installation of slope stabilization measures prior to slope failure and potential remobilization of contaminants. So this is really a proactive approach. We developed a technical standard operating procedure, a TSOP, to install acoustic Doppler profilers within our creeks to monitor surface water flow and water levels over time. Again, they're continuous flow velocity collection. They're attached to the bottom of the channel. They can withstand heavy flooding conditions as well as low water levels, and we were able to connect to a telemetry device so we can download the data in real time. Due to projected climate change impacts associated with more frequent precipitation and storm events, the average water level and surface water flow may increase over time. Therefore, the data can be used to identify storms and associate high peaks in water level and surface water flow to assess site conditions during a storm event and related impacts to the remedy's integrity. This is a figure here showing the Wissahickon Creek flow data. The average flow is around 1.53 meters cubed per second, which along the scale is towards the bottom. So this is the historic average flow here, and these are the readings that we've been collecting over the past 2 years. So you can see that there are instances where the flow in the creek is well above average.
Melda, it's cubic feet on the y-axis. That's why you're confused.
On the y-axis. Thank you, Mitch.
So it's really like 50 CFS.
Ah, okay. Got it. Thank you. So, you know, the overall goal is for us to determine if an increase in the average baseline water level and surface water flow has increased over time to assess if current conditions at a particular point maintain the remedy's integrity or has the potential to impact the remedy's integrity, thus prompting mitigation measures. No storm events are recorded yet during this 2-year period of vulnerability assessment monitoring. So I don't think we have a good data point or set at this point in time, but that's not really the purpose. The purpose is for us to continuously monitor changes over time. This is just a graph showing the water elevation data over time. And not only will this information help us, you know, check water elevation changes, but also inform on any seasonal influence where the creek may not be retaining water. So in closing of this case study, maintaining the climate change vulnerability monitoring component of the O&M to help manage potential risk of contaminant remobilization due to a severe weather or flood event into perpetuity. The data collected today will help inform further decisions on remedial action maintenance to ensure overall protectiveness to the environment and human health. The data set can be used as a tool to communicate to the public and other stakeholders, such as EPA, Water Commission, FEMA, that a severe weather or flood event will likely not undermine the remedy based on the most current hydrologic conditions and remedial action design factors. So I'm going to take a pause here and see if there are any questions on case studies one or two.
Yes, we have a number of questions that came in, and if you're in the middle of typing another one in, go right ahead. I'm going to start with the ones that we have in the queue. So this first one is back on referencing slides 16 and 17, and they just wondered if you could review the colors that you had on those slides. I can try to jump you
sure.
back there if that'll be helpful.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay. And so, again, I believe that was one of the line charts where you had
the analysis. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
I know I didn't have the video at that point in time.
Yep, up, went a little too far. There we go. So I believe, yeah, exactly.
Here we go. So we have percent reduction in cancer risk along the y-axis, and the cost of each alternative along this secondary y-axis here. And here is the different no action, alternative A, alternative B, alternative C. And these are the four areas that were included in the cost risk analysis that represent like 70% of the contamination on site. So if alternative A is implemented, you kind of go up to these points here, and for each of these four areas, you're getting a percent reduction in risk. It looks like between 80 and maybe 98%, and you have a cost maybe around $100 million. And then similar for alternative B, you go up here, this is where your cost of alternative B is, and then your overall reduction in cancer risk. So the takeaway from doing this analysis was that you're able to achieve your optimal reduction in cancer risk by removing the material using the alternative B cleanup standards in a similar manner as the alternative C cleanup standards, but alternative C has additional costs associated with it.
Okay. And speaking of costs, we just had a question asking, how do you monetize the environmental footprint assessment? They note that they saw there were measurement units and then costs, but they had missed the conversation where you were converting tons of GHG and other metrics to dollars.
Yeah, so different environmental metrics can have a representative social cost. So for example, for greenhouse gas emissions, that is comprised of CO2, nitrous oxide, and methane. So you can get the social cost of that environmental metric. For example, in this particular scenario here back in 2016, using the assumptions that we used, the cost of one metric ton of greenhouse gas emissions was approximated to be $183. If you multiply 24,000 tons of greenhouse gas emissions by $183 per metric ton, you get that overall cost of $4.3 million. This unit is very high, 183, since 2016, we have made some modifications to the way we're quantifying the social cost of greenhouse gas emissions. So I think that number would actually be closer to like $50 or $60 per metric ton. But what I think the important takeaway here is this is not to be used to say that we're paying this in monetary damages. This is not the use of this at all. This is just to help us normalize disparate metrics into one common unit for ease of comparison.
Okay. And we've had a couple of people ask about the impact or the result of doing this type of an evaluation. So people have asked, you know, if doing this type of analysis has helped shift state regulators into accepting a particular approach, or can you help them understand how doing these types of evaluations changed the decisions you were making at the sites? Because in some of the data that you presented, some people seem that the decision was rather obvious independent of that evaluation.
Sure. For Stan and Susanna, I cannot speak to a decision that was made because this was just performed to support the EIA. But what I would like to point out here is it's not always as obvious. you know, do we, I think oftentimes we think we may be implementing, you know, the smallest footprint, or we want to implement the remedy that removes 100% of the contamination, where there may be a more optimal approach to address maybe 93 to 99% of that contamination, and by doing so, you're able to significantly reduce your environmental, social, and economic impact. But at the same time, you're not implementing a remedy that has, you know, the least amount of sustainability impact. You're not achieving that ultimate risk reduction. So it's a nice way to transparently have that conversation. I think for the environmental footprint analysis, it was obvious in this particular case, but it's not always that obvious. And then for BORIT, you know, capping could have a high environmental footprint depending upon the type of capping material that you're utilizing and where you're getting that cap material. So it's really dependent upon a site-specific basis. For BORIT, it just happened to be that the capping had the least overall sustainability impact, and I believe that helped inform them on moving forward with that particular technology. And then from the resiliency perspective, we knew that the cap could be vulnerable to such flood events, and we wanted to be sure that we were designing and putting in O&M measures to ensure that our cap integrity maintains itself during such an event, if it happens now or into the future.
Okay. I'm going to take one more question now, but I also wanted to throw another topic out at you before we move on. There have been a lot of requests for references on how you developed these unit costs, social costs, how you were calculating risks, where's the guidance that you are using for monetizing these costs? So lots of questions for specific references. I want to come back to those later. I just want to take one more question because I'm seeing even more of them come in. So I want to let them kind of queue up, and then we may come back to them later. But this other question that came in is just getting into the level of effort with the tools that you were using. So one attendee wanted to know how complex or what was the level of effort that you needed to use CIFA and SiteWise. They wanted to know how much did it cost you to use these tools, how long did it take to use them?
Well, for utilizing the environmental footprint tools, you can do it in a very cost-effective manner if you have a good data inventory, and that if that data inventory does not change. What I mean by that, when you're putting together your FS, you're assuming a certain amount of wells are going to go in, a certain amount of material is going to be removed, you're going to use a certain amount of amendments, and you can, you know, do a sustainability assessment, run your footprint analysis. The engineers are already getting that data as part of their costing, so it's really easy to just utilize that data set and put into a footprint tool. You know, doing a really good evaluation probably would be around 40 hours, depending upon the complexity of the technologies and strategies that you're looking at and how similar they are to each other. If you start looking at a wide different variety of technologies, your time may go up. But I think a lot of time is spent when you start changing that data inventory after you already did your analysis, and then you're kind of reworking the analysis that you did. So if you can put a good effort to make sure you have a solid data set, you can do these type of analyses rather quickly. From a resiliency evaluation, from a qualitative sense, you could, you know, do that in a day, just talking with the team and utilizing some of those desktop analysis tools. But if you need to do any sort of like hydrodynamic modeling, which Mitch is going to present on during case study 4, that's going to be, you know, a significant effort depending upon what your data objectives are and the availability of models and data.
Okay. All right. So as I said earlier, there were a ton of questions about references for calculating.
Yeah, the social test.
Yeah.
So I have publications on that I'd be happy to send on the approach that was implemented. And as much as possible, we try to use social cost metrics that are vetted in the literature. EPA publishes the social cost of carbon as well as methane and nitrous oxide, and then there's a report that we use that has regional social cost for NOx and SOx emissions, so we can take into account how those emissions into the atmosphere are impacting more regional water quality, like contributions to smog and so forth. So these are numbers that EPA has published a handful for, and I have publications on the approach that I can send to people.
All right, great. Well, I think right now, just in the interest of time, why don't we carry on with the presentation? But I want to, again, thank that audience for sharing their questions and comments. Continue to encourage you to send them on in. And I'll just do a quick time check that we're just after 2 o'clock Eastern time right now.
Okay. Well, I think I need to get to, all right. All right, case studies 3 and 4. So now we're going to go a little bit heavier into the resiliency aspect of this presentation, but also touching upon sustainability elements. So for case study 3, this is the Portland Harbor Superfund site, which showcases incorporation of sustainable resilient remediation at the remedial design stage. Remedial design guidelines were developed to consider and perform a seismic design evaluation, climate change resiliency evaluation, a community impact assessment, and incorporation of green remediation best practices. 2 remedial design workshops were performed to solicit stakeholder feedback on these remedial design guidelines. The workshop format was comprised of technical presentations followed by open forums and stakeholder breakout sessions with a facilitator. Whiteboarding was used as a tool to capture stakeholder input in real time and confirm there was a common understanding of the technical material being presented, as well as consensus on capturing major discussion points, stakeholder concerns, and action items. The open forum and breakout sessions format provided opportunities to work through some technical questions and brainstorm on format of the guidelines that would best meet stakeholder needs, both from responsible parties as well as affected stakeholders, community, tribal stakeholders, and also other agencies that were involved with the cleanup. During the workshop, EPA presented on the history of seismic activity in the site area, literature review, and project experience key findings, as well as initial design recommendations for the seismic guidelines. This, again, helped to build a common understanding of the problem. Why do we want to incorporate a seismic or consider seismic in the design? And then solicit feedback that was ultimately integrated into the design guideline that was prepared. A climate change resiliency evaluation design guideline was developed to identify, evaluate, select, and implement remedial action components that are resilient to dynamic hydrologic site conditions due to both seasonality and storm events. Currently and in the future, as well as considering sea level rise. And I'm going to touch upon those individual components in the next slide. Remedy components that were identified to be most vulnerable to these climate change drivers was maintaining the cap integrity and shoreline stabilization. The Climate Change Resiliency Evaluation Design Guidelines provides a framework to perform hydrodynamic modeling to support design of the cap, backfill, and other engineering controls. The guideline itself provides recommendations on where the designers can find climate change projection data sets, so, you know, precipitation projections based on a particular emission scenario and a planning horizon. Gave information on which storm event to model, considerations that need to be included for the backwater effect from the nearby Columbia River, as well as the planning horizon that the design should be designed for. It also provided a USGS model as a resource that can be used as a potential starting point to build from to incorporate these additional climate change drivers and design conditions for the Portland Harbor site itself. The remedial design considerations of community impact included mitigation measures and best management practices to minimize unintended consequences from remedial action activities, both during in-water and on-land activities. So you can see here, which I think is a really interesting one, is you want to mitigate increased river traffic. That was a concern among the stakeholders. And then also maintaining the fish consumption advisories until RAOs are achieved. And then lastly, a green remediation practices remedial design guideline was developed to facilitate the consideration of best management practices that minimize environmental footprint of site activities, consider measures to reduce impacts of habitat, such as compensatory mitigation loss, and increase opportunity for healthy recreation activities. A requirement was also included in the green remediation plan to include discussions how resource impacts will be mitigated to the extent possible. So that was just a quick case study summary of the sustainable and resilient remedial design guidelines that was prepared to help the designers for the Portland Harbor site, which is comprised of several different groups of designers. So I think that was one of the primary objectives, so that everyone's working from a common understanding and a resource set. Okay, and then I'm going to hand it over to Mitch to present on case study 4.
Thank you, Mel. Everyone can hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes? Okay, great. So I noticed in a previous slide that it said I was going to be talking about the hydrodynamic modeling. I'm actually not talking about the modeling per se. We're talking about the upfront analysis to determine design storm size. So in the third bullet there, you see the key thing that we were trying to do is analyze existing rainfall data to figure out the depth of the 100-year, 24-hour rainfall to be used as input to hydrodynamic modeling to assess what kind of facilities are needed for stormwater conveyance and storage. So the Formosa Mine site is located in southwestern Oregon, about 50 miles north of the California border and about 70 miles inland up in the hills. And the mine was active back in the 1920s and 30s and again briefly in the 90s. And so the objective for Superfund is to remediate the tailings and everything else from the mine and assess long-term O&M to keep the mine impacted materials out of the stream. Whoops. I click. It's a little got ahead of myself there. I'll get this right. There we go. So the key thing about rainfall analysis these days is that NOAA, the National Oceanographic Administration and Atmospheric Administration, puts out rainfall atlases that characterizes what is, for instance, the 100-year 24-hour rainfall, as well as all kinds of other statistics, the 5-year 1-hour rainfall, the 60-day 3-day rainfall, etc. In most of the country, for many years, the standard document was called TP40. That was put out back in 1961. In the western U.S., the key document for many years was NOAA Atlas II, put out in 1973. In the early 2000s, NOAA started updating those atlases, and at this point, they've now updated 45 out of the 50 states, plus the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, but the Northwest has not been included in that update, and at present, there are no funds in NOAA to carry forth with reanalysis of design rainfall statistics for the Northwest. So we're left with a 50-year-old atlas, which on the scale of rainfall analysis is pretty old, since we're talking about rainfall data that most of the data sets are pretty robust after the 1940s. Some of the data goes back to the early 1900s. But, you know, even on the scale of a station that goes back to 1900, we had 70 years of data back in 1970, and nowadays there's 120 years of data to work with. So on the one hand, you would just want a larger data set, especially if you're trying to understand a rare event such as 100-year rainfall. On the other hand, you want to understand how things might be changing over time. So we took a couple of approaches to doing the analysis to check up on what the number should be. First was to just start from Atlas II, look at its statistics, and then apply some guidance that EPA has promulgated for making climate adjustments for looking out into the future 50 years or so. The second method was to do the analysis anew, looking at the available data and trying to do our own statistical analysis of the regional rainfall gauges and identify, one, whether we could observe climate change in the historic data sets, and two, just redoing the analysis with the full 120 or so years worth of data available at some of these stations. So to use the, first we can go look up the old number in Atlas, in Atlas II, and I think the 100-year 24-hour rainfall in the Atlas for this particular site is 6.5 inches. Then we want to say, well, what's it going to be 50 years from now? So back in 2014, EPA put out a small piece of software, essentially a guidance software called SWIMCAT. SWIM is the EPA Stormwater Management Model, which you saw in my resume I've been involved with for many years, and CAT is the climate adjustment tool. So this is just a tool to identify for various, you can see on the slide there, for temperature, evaporation, rainfall, and design storms to figure out, get estimates based on the international, climate analysis, the CMIT project, to look at the ensembles of different climate models and say, well, okay, 50 years from now, how do we think the 100-year 24-hour rainfall or some other design rainfall may have changed? And those three lines you see there, this is just straight out of that software. All you do is you plug in a zip code and you tell it whether you want the near term being 2020 to 2049, which we're already into the near term. As I said, the software was put out in 2014. It has not been updated since. You can see the version number down there, 1.000. And then it gives the three different ensembles of climate models. And this shows that two of the groups of models, the hot-dry models and the median, the hot-dry models and the warm-wet models, they say that the 100-year rainfall for this area will go up between 12 and 13%, whereas the median group of models says that it expects that the 100-year 24-hour rainfall would go up more like 16%. So we then can take that information and apply a range and figure out an estimate for the change in the 100-year 24-hour rainfall out into the future. That's method one, pretty straightforward. Method two is to look at the data ourselves. And for this, we found 8 gauges around the area. You can see a couple of rings showing 25 and 50-mile radii from the site. And we have a lot of topography here and a lot of elevation change, so we needed to examine carefully as we look at those gauges. You can see the out at the coast, the rainfall is much higher, and then you get a rain shadow, and there's more rain a bit further inland. But through the Global Historic Climate Network, which is a NOAA compendium of over 100,000 rain gauges around the world, we found 8 gauges within the study area or around the study area. And we then decided that the one gauge that was actually the closest, I think or one of the closest, was not very adequate for our use, the Silver Butte gauge, but that still left us with 7 gauges to do some analysis on. So the first thing we did was plot up the annual precipitation from each of those gauges. When you're looking at rainfall data, precipitation data because this includes snow. When you're looking at these long-term data sets, you need to be careful anytime you're looking at a station that's not a major airport because there can be missing data all over the place and stations go on and offline. They take a month off, they take a year off. But in this case, you can see we've got pretty good records, and we have 3 of the stations going back to the very early 1900s. And so we plotted up all the annual precipitation, and you can see, it looks like it's more variable in recent years. Partly there's just more stations, and partly it looks like we also have a couple of stations that were not necessarily recording the best data for a couple of years. But when we take all that data and put it together of the 7 best sites and normalize it to each of their long-term averages, and we look at a 20-year moving average trend, we can see that, the rainfall really hasn't changed significantly anywhere around this area over the last 120 years, which means that the data set is stationary is the term we use, and we can then do an analysis of the frequency statistics of those gauges to identify, looking at all this data, the 120 years worth, what is the 100-year 24-hour rainfall. We would expect, since we see what looks like a stationary data set, that our numbers shouldn't be that much different from what NOAA got 50 years ago. The differences would be that we now have slightly more stations and that we have some slightly better methods. But there's a, we don't expect to see anything very different from what NOAA came up with. To drill down in a little more detail and look and see if we could identify any trends that just weren't obvious from that annual data set, we looked at, what about are there trends in the extreme rainfall? So what you see plotted up there are 40-year moving window analyses of the 2-year and the 100-year rainfall. So what we do is we, for a single rain gauge, we say, okay, I'm just going to look back at the last 40 years, and over 40 years, if I'm looking for a 2-year rainfall, I should have about 20 events that exceed a 2-year rainfall. So essentially, what's the 20th biggest event in my 40-year window? That's without getting into the statistics of how we assess the distributions. That's basically what we're doing when we look for the 2-year rainfall, and what you see when you look at all 3 of those stations is it's sitting in about the same place. The top station is about 2 inches, middle station is also about 2 inches, and the last station at the bottom is about 3 inches. When we look at the 100-year rainfall, we see things moving around a little bit. The movement looks kind of random, and part of the issue that goes on there is when you're looking at 100-year rainfall, and we're looking at only a 40-year window, we don't expect to have a 100-year event, there's a decent chance we have a 100-year event in any data set, but we're basing it, instead of having 20 events to work with, we're looking at half an event, and we're much more dependent on on how we plot the statistical distribution of the data to identify what we think is the 100-year rainfall. So when we do that analysis, anytime we get a year with a big an event in it, it can throw that analysis off in one direction or the other. But basically, we're seeing that just as the 2-year rainfall, 2-year one-day rainfall appears to be stationary, the 100-year one-day rainfall also appears to be stationary. So again, we could have found a different result here than just looking at the annual data, because it's possible the annual rainfall could stay the same or even go down, while the extreme rainfall, the largest events, could be going up. But in this particular case, we didn't see anything. So we did some pretty fancy analysis, but the results aren't all that exciting. Now, this doesn't mean, of course, that when we look forward 50 years, that things aren't going to change more markedly, but that depends now on climate modeling, not on analysis of the historic data. Just as a third check on things, we looked at the 2017 Oregon Climate Assessment, and they said in that report that they expect extreme precipitation days to increase 15 to 39% across Oregon. So nothing very specific that we could really say, okay, this is a number we're going to apply to our study. So finally, the way we decided to go forth with the numbers to use for the stream analysis for the site is to, while we got numbers that were slightly different from doing our analysis of the 8 gauges around the area, we decided to just stick with the ATLAS number, which says that the 100-year 24-hour rainfall is 6.5 inches. We applied a climate change factor based on SWIMCAT of 15.6%, and that gives us a final recommended rainfall depth of 7.5 inches for the 50-year horizon. And I believe that's the last of my slides, and so we are ready now for the Q&A for both the last case study that Mel presented, as well as for this case study.
All right, thank you. So again, I'll remind everybody that they can use that Q&A window to share their comments or questions. And we'll start with this first question that's already in about the Columbia River. So one attendee noted that for Columbia River backwater effects, how did the multiple dams in the river basin factor into your evaluation? They want to know what potential impacts did sea level rise present to the site, being that it was a good distance upstream from the mouth of the river.
So I will attempt to answer that question, and I know I do have a team member online if they want to add a response. But this the analysis was not performed yet. To my knowledge, to be able to answer the question of what the effects actually would be from current sea level rise or backwater effect estimates, the guideline was indicating that that needs to be considered when performing your hydrodynamic model and having that model, be comprehensive in representing site conditions and then informing on design of your capping and your backfill material. Vorda, I don't know if there's anything to add to that. Okay, she sent me a little IM that is correct. Okay, thank you.
Okay. We also had another comment about climate change, and this participant noted that the problem of climate change is not the annual average precipitation, but the concentration of precipitation in a small period of time that can contribute to a fall of water with a huge destruction potential. And so I don't know if either of you could speak to that comment.
Go ahead.
I'll answer first. I mean, in the case of the foremost line, that is the kind of analysis we were doing, is looking for the change in the extreme rainfall. So, yes, we looked at the annual rainfall and how that might be changing, but we're also looking at the expected change in the 100-year 24-hour rainfall. As you saw from my plots in the historic data, we don't see any change so far. Over 120 years, but that's not to say that climate isn't changing and that we may see significant changes in, or in this case, we're projecting a 15%, or estimating a 15% change in the intensity of the 100-year 24-hour rainfall. I guess I'm presuming that question might have been more directed at the case study 3 now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'll remind everybody that if you don't have questions on the last two case studies, you can also put that in, because I do have some other questions and comments that have identified that they're actually about earlier case studies, but I want to allow for time for questions and comments on these last two. So if you have no additional questions for case studies 3 and 4, just type in no questions, and I will wait for a few remarks or responses to that, and then if I don't see any additional questions on those last two, if it's okay with our presenters, I'll go back to some additional questions that have come in for your earlier case studies. And looking at this, I'm seeing confirmation that there are no questions that are coming in for these last two, and they want to go back to the first two. So if that's all right, Mel, is it okay if I go back with some additional questions for those first two?
Well, if I could maybe propose just maybe we'll do the last slide that's just like additional lessons learned from other projects, just in case, you know, some people need to sign off earlier, and then we can dive into those case study 1 and 2 questions. So, you know, as you saw through these case studies, the approach we went about considering sustainability and resiliency was really site-specific. Depending upon the project lifecycle stage, stakeholder concerns and needs, and technologies that we were looking at. So, but it doesn't encompass all of the lessons learned that we've had over the past couple years. So I just want to share that with you. Lessons learned that we have on our end is, you know, sustainable resilient remediation is more successfully implemented when it's considered and budgeted during the project planning stage. Every company, is including now agencies and responsible parties, have sustainable resilient remediation experts. So, you know, reach out to those experts, and to help you guide what that budget and approach would be, you know, it's a really great idea to develop SMART goals. So that you can have a common understanding of what you're trying to achieve by performing a sustainable and resilient remediation assessment. From a sustainable remediation lessons learned, sometimes best management practices can be challenging due to subcontractor equipment availability. Experiences have been with the clean diesel option for earthwork equipment. As well as there was some lessons learned on identifying an appropriate ADP as well for BORIT. So while you're identifying equipment to meet your best management practices, it's good to reach out to people that has experience to address some of those challenges. And then lastly, for resilient remediation, you know, level of effort is really dependent upon the availability of H&H models and data sets. And one, we did have one case study where we did hydrodynamic modeling along a coastal system for a sediment site, and we did find that there was a decrease in vulnerability to wave action and erosional forces from future storm events due to sea level rise, because the bottom of the water body was now further away from the surface of the surface water body. So that wave action and erosional forces in current time would actually decrease in the future, because like we're putting more water into a tub and that top of that water is no longer interacting with the bottom surface. So sometimes you do these assessments and you find takeaways that you weren't expecting. So just to reiterate that I think it's really important to do site-specific assessments. So, yeah, we can go into questions.
Okay.
Oh, and special thanks to all EPA and USDOE project teams for, you know, letting us have this opportunity to share all the good work we're doing and providing support with the presentations.
Thank you so much. I'm going to actually circle back here. We did have a comment from Mike Allen as well. So, Mitch, he did just want to also confirm that at the Formosa mine site, the intensity of rainfall was specifically addressed in the risk analysis. So that does go in line with what you were mentioning earlier. Okay, so we did have a question that came in about, in addition to your use of the EPA Greener Cleanup Guidance, have you used the ASTM Greener Cleanup Standard?
Yes, the ASTM Greener Cleanup Standard, and ASTM also has a, I'm not going to remember the right one, the exact title off the top of my head, I apologize, but it's integration of sustainability into cleanup activities. And both those guidances have a very extensive best management practice list. So definitely, you know, that is an excellent resource that we use. In addition, it has a really great flow chart of, you know, when you want to consider BMPs versus when you want to do a more quantitative assessment for sustainability or green remediation, which is also in alignment with ITRC and all the other guidances out there. So utilizing the ASTM standards is great, and I always go to it as a BMP resource.
Okay. Do you have any input about the EPA's 9 criteria when they're looking at Superfund site evaluation, if you've seen or heard any insights into incorporating SRRs as part of these 9 criteria when they're evaluating Superfund sites?
I do not anticipate there will be any changes in the 9 NCP criteria. I think that would be a very difficult task to achieve. However, we utilize different metrics and indicators to help us evaluate that criteria, right? We use mass discharge assessment and metrics. We use bioavailability metrics to help us evaluate those 9 criteria. So the approach is you utilize your sustainability assessment, you utilize your resiliency evaluation to help you evaluate that criteria and to make a more informed decision.
Okay. We have a question about capping from one of the remedies that you discussed earlier. And the participant noted that capping from the selected remedy is really important, not only to sort of limit erosion, but also minimizing the surface water pollution with silt. And so they were wondering if you have any references or technical resources that you used for your measurements?
For the cap design itself?
Yes.
I do not have that information, no.
Okay. All right. We also had a question on case study 1. Did you have or are you aware if there are any restrictions on land use at that site?
I am not aware of any land use restrictions. I know I have a team member on the line. I don't know if he has additional information on that.
I don't think I do.
Okay. Thank you, Ian.
All right, how about for case study number 2? They noted that it looks like resiliency was based on past events. So with climate change, past events are not necessarily predictive of future events. So they were wondering if you could clarify how these future production or projections are being calculated.
So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, puts out a guidance on and resources on what are potential increases in precipitation and temperature over time in terms of both frequency and amount. So you know, those resources can be looked at, and those are also the resources that are used in some of those desktop tools. So there's that previous slide of the Massachusetts DEP web-based platform where it shows, you know, what is the anticipated sea level rise, and that's based on NOAA data sets, and then you have what is the anticipated increase of precipitation or temperature projections within my property. So this is all kind of feeding from the IPCC's data set. So I would say that's informing us from what are the potential for climate change related hazards to occur within your particular area. Mitch, I don't know if you have anything to add to that response.
I mentioned the EPA SWIMCAT tool. EPA has also had another tool called CREATE, Climate Resilient something about it's for utilities. CREATE was available as a piece of software, and now it's just an online tool, but it basically uses the same set of scenarios that the SWIMCAT is using to look at projections. It's a bit tricky to, you know, as you see, even in SWIMCAT, you see the, you know, diverging lines for, you know, the forecasts are, have a large range of uncertainty, but, you know, and at this point, even SWIMCAT, you know, which was now 6 years old, that the, you know, it only takes us up to, even assuming that forecast remains valid, it only takes us up to 50 years from now. So there is a need for more guidance, and, right, the IPCC reports are not very specific. And, you know, looking at a site like we're seeing there in my Oregon mine, you know, if I showed you sites from elsewhere in the country, we'd see huge changes, not huge, but, you know, we'd see significant changes going on already. And that same kind of analysis I showed you with the moving window, you know, we can see significant changes in the southeast of that over the past 50 years, the size of the 100-year rainfall has actually gone up pretty significantly. And it's actually a bit of a problem even now that the NOAA atlases that have just been reissued or just been redeveloped over the last decade, they're based on the assumption of stationarity. They did analysis as they did the studies to say, well, you know, can we consider this data stationary? And in all the cases, they concluded it could be. But at the same time, they've also acknowledged that even though the data didn't necessarily jump out and say specifically it wasn't stationary, we know that the climate is not stationary, and we know that whatever change has been going on is going to accelerate. So there are certainly challenges in that field. And NOAA was forming the same folks did the Climate Atlas. Had a working group looking into it. I'm not actually sure what the status of it is at the moment, since that kind of research has not been a big priority in the last couple of years, shall we say?
Okay. All right. We have a question. These are some follow-up questions about capping. And we had a participant who just noted that caps are often designed to meet 100-year storms, but not to meet the 500-year storms. And they were just wondering if you had encountered or had gone through that with your sites. And they just carry on to just clarify that there's some concern that they can't get conservative caps in place if there isn't a push to be more conservative with the design.
I mean, my experience with our capping projects have primarily been to design to the 100-year storm events and not the 500-year storm events. I think it really goes back to, you know, having that align with what your stakeholder concerns and values are, and the history of your site. Is there a history of flooding going on at your property? There may be a little bit more of a significant driver to be more conservative. But kind of playing into like our previous conversation and this conversation, that's where I think it's really important to do climate change vulnerability monitoring after we install these technologies, especially when we're, you know, managing contaminants in situ. We're projecting that there's going to be a change. We're designing for a particular event, but if we're not monitoring what's actually going on at our site continuously and reevaluating how those projections change, we're really doing ourselves a disservice and can get into a sticky situation. So I think that these comments have a really valid point that, you know, there is a level of uncertainty with using climate data and these projections, but that shouldn't be used as a rationale for not utilizing them. We want to be protected. We want our remedy to maintain its integrity, but at the same time, we have to do our due diligence to monitor the fact that we're still meeting our design conditions because we are living in a situation of uncertainty.
Okay. Just a few more questions here. So you had talked earlier about social costs, and there was a question if you were including environmental justice concerns in with those types of costs.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I have not come across any social cost metrics that are related to environmental justice for remediation projects. I have looked at social cost metrics from that perspective when I was working on a green infrastructure versus gray infrastructure cost-benefit analysis. And what we did was we looked at the poverty index and how that index may change based on restoration of the site and utilized literature to help us come up with an appropriate approach and cost. So I do not think that that cannot be applied if that is a factor that you want to consider. It could definitely be incorporated, and it has been incorporated by several municipalities from a stormwater management perspective.
Okay. All right. And then just can you share how you calculated your percent cancer risk reduction?
I do not know the answer to that question. Ian, do you know the answer to that question?
So we have numbers. We have numbers that's equivalent to 10 to the minus 6 cancer risk reduction. Compare the using exposure point concentration, we compare that after excavation, the assumed excavation, the remaining risk, we compare the remaining risk, you know, using a newly calculated exposure point concentration and compare it to the 10 to the minus 6 equivalent, and then determine the difference and calculated the percent reduction based on that. So we assumed if you remove to the 10 to the minus 6 cancer risk, then you would have removed 100% of the risk.
Okay. We actually had a couple of additional questions that just popped in, so I think we have a few more moments and we can take these. One of the attendees wanted to know, does your process include a design adaptation as a goal in addition to the robust design where risks are over the design?
I'm not sure I understand.
So So it says, does this process include design adaptation as a goal in addition to robust design? And then in parentheses, which risks over design? Or I think they perhaps, they might be implying that if you're trying to get a robust design, you could wind mm-hmm. up having something that's over-designed as opposed to designing something that might be adaptable or flexible and isn't, that you can modify without, implementing something massively over-designed, if that makes sense.
I mean, if I'm understanding the question correctly, there is definitely a role of adaptive management when it comes to sustainable resilient remediation. Building a system that is adaptable to changing regulatory conditions, emerging contaminants, or even climate change considerations, there's always an opportunity to look at and optimize and incorporate sustainability and resiliency. I would not advocate over designing just for sustainability and resiliency unless there is, a really true return on investment that, is the driver for doing that over design. Everything we do from a sustainability and resiliency perspective should be done in a cost-effective manner and in being alignment with stakeholder values. And that's why it's so important talking about this during project planning, because I think it helps you map out how you're going to consider sustainability and resiliency. What does that mean for my design? What does that mean in the context of an adaptive management approach? I mean, it's all interrelated, really.
Okay. We had a follow-on question regarding EJ. Someone wanted to know, are there initiatives to model contaminate transport from sediment sites to EJ communities during these storm events? They were just thinking of sediment sites and flooding.
I'm not aware of any initiatives for sediment transport and potential impacts to EJ communities. I don't know if anyone else on the line has any knowledge of that.
Mal, Bowritt is an EJ community, so I would say in that sense, doing everything we can for it not to happen, within that community.
Similarly, Formosa Mine, there's an Indian tribe. The Umpqua Indian tribe is downstream, and they were one of the stakeholders and involved in the, all the presentations.
Okay.
Go ahead. Sorry, Jean.
Oh no, no. Go ahead. Go ahead now.
So I would just reiterate what Lucinda and Mitch said in that the EJ communities and having them have a voice and get an understanding of what their concerns are from a sustainability and resiliency perspective was really important. And we also got that for Portland Harbor, the tribal stakeholders are a primary stakeholder at that site as well.
All right, excellent. Well, I think we're running near the end of our time today, and I think we've managed to get through the bulk of the questions. I do just want to return back. Mel, earlier in the day, you had noted that you have a number of references and resources that you might be able to share with the audience. So I just wanted you to know that a number of people have typed in their email address and have asked to make sure that we get those to you.
Good.
So what I'll do, Mel, is if you can work to share those links or resources to Kate and I, we'll make them available as part of the seminar archive, and then we'll notify all of the registrants when these resources are available to access. Okay.
Excellent. I'm really happy everyone's interested in learning more. This is great.
All right. And so at this time, what I want to do is invite Kate Garufi, if you're on the line. Kate, I believe we had a few other questions that came in earlier today asking people to revisit the symposium and other webinars and events that are planned. So can you provide a recap of what you shared earlier?
Sure, and I apologize if there was some lack of clarity. Given the fact that we have some challenging times right now, I have this ever-changing schedule. First, I wanted to talk about the webinars. I noticed that one question asked how they could be involved or registered for the monthly SAME EPA DCHWS webinars. The webinars, which I mentioned before, which are held monthly, are put on by EPA through our CLUIN webinar training platform. Therefore, the best way to be aware of the webinars is to go to the CLUIN EPA webpage, which will have a calendar of events and trainings of which these will be posted generally. And correct me if I'm wrong, Jean, it's generally the second Wednesday of every month is around the time frame when those webinars are. In addition to the CLUIN website and the calendar of training events, there's also the TechDirect newsletter, which has training events in there. So that will also be announcing any upcoming events. I encourage you to keep an eye on both of those, again, for the June, July, and August deliveries. I did not announce specific topics because I'm trying to fill those slots with some of the presentations that had to be moved around given that we postponed the April 2020 Philly Symposium. So related to the symposiums, as I mentioned before, EPA and SAME put on two symposiums a year, one on the East Coast in the April timeframe, one in the West in Denver, so not necessarily West Coast, but Western part of the U.S., Denver in the October-November timeframe. This year being 2020, we developed an agenda for the April event. We had a full agenda set, presentations were ready, and due to the COVID situation, we ended up having to postpone and cancel the April DCHWS East Symposium. It is not being rescheduled this year, but it is going on April of next year. So there is no Philadelphia Symposium in 2020. We are continuing to plan for its sister symposium in Denver, which is October 26th through 28, 2020. We're currently planning to put it on during those dates unless something changes. What I mentioned earlier was that because we already had a robust agenda for the Philly event, we're moving that agenda with the predominance of the presentations to the West event. So the West has graciously offered to put on the agenda from the East Symposium. We will be adding some presentations due to some conflicts. So the West Symposium, DCHWS in Denver, we will continue the planning efforts October 26th through 28th. The registration is not open yet. When it is, I will be working with Jean to announce that on CLUIN as well. So I hope that provided some clarification for everybody. The last thing I wanted to note on DCHWS, since we have the symposiums, the webinars, and the potential in-person construction management training in the next year or so, I'm working with SAME to develop a comprehensive DCHWS website, which will house all of these events so that it will be a one-stop shop so you can sort of see where everything is. Once that is available, I will announce that on future webinars and put it in the seminar resources for everybody. So I hope that answers some of the questions, Jean, and I turn it back over to you.
All right. Thank you so much, Kate. At this time, I want to walk through just a few final reminders. First, I'll just express the gratitude that I'm starting to see from the comments. The audience was very appreciative of today's session, so I want to be sure that our organizers and presenters know that they really did appreciate your time and expertise. We had about 230 people who are on live for today's webinar, and I'm glad you were able to join us. As Kate noted, you can learn more about sessions like these in the series, as well as a wide variety of other resources on cleaning up hazardous waste sites. You'll find us at the Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. We're at CLUIN.org. There is a free monthly newsletter called Tech Direct that I send out on the first of each month, and you can sign up for that at the URL shown here. And I've also included that in the Q&A window for quick reference. So I do encourage you to subscribe to that newsletter, or you can check our training calendar for upcoming seminars. For those of you who are looking for copies of the slides, we have those posted as a PDF file on our resources page. And then as I get additional resources from our presenters, I'll add them on that page. In about 1 to 2 weeks, we should have an archive from today's session available for on-demand playback, and we'll automatically email each of you when that archive is available. You'll be able to find the archive, get to the resources page, access the additional files that we've added in at that time as well. If you're looking for follow-on contact information, we already have information for our presenters. As noted, they included it in their presentation content, and we have it on that seminar homepage. That's the same page you were directed to when you checked in for today's webinar, and it'll be active from this point forward. And then I will ask each of you to fill out our brief online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery, both in the manner that we did it as well as the content that was covered. I often get asked if we offer CEUs or PDHs. While we do not offer those for our sessions, we can give you a participation certificate with complete details for the events. You can obtain one of those after filling out a feedback form for our session, but you need to do two very important things. First, follow the link to the seminar feedback form. You'll find it on the middle right under related URLs. You can click the link and then press the Browse To button to open it. I've also put that in the Q&A window, so you can scroll up a little bit further and you'll find it there. Once you visit that seminar feedback form, please be sure that your email address is entered correctly and that you check the box at the bottom certifying you were here for the whole thing. If you happen to be the lucky person replaying the archive, you can still follow the link in the archive to the feedback form. You can still complete feedback based off of a replay. And then once you submit the feedback form, whether it's now or based off of an archive replay, you'll immediately have access to a certificate that you can either download or print out for your own records. If you don't check that box, if you don't put your email address in, we have no way to share that information with you. If for some reason there were others joining you at your location today, each person can actually fill out that feedback form even if they didn't register individually. So I'll ask that you share the link to the feedback form with anyone else who may have participated via your connection. And so with that, again, I want to thank all of our presenters, all of our participants and organizers as well for joining us. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and that we'll have you on for a future webinar. And with that, we'll formally conclude today's live broadcast.